we'll begin with the prayers. I'm moving the phone a little bit. Deidre, let me know if at any point you can't hear clearly. Okay. Sorry, I have to get my screen back. No, it's on. Right. It's no, that's not it. Okay, that's not working. Hold on just a sec. We're having another little hi Dano. I'm having a little technical thing right here, but I'm about to solve it. There we go. All right, we're gonna do our prayers now. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. To all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And my prayers, my teacher prayers, you're still there, Deidre, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I had another call coming in, which I sent a voicemail. Okay. So my teacher prayers, my aspirations as a teacher for this session, Four Dharmas of Gompopa. Dadan Semchen Tom Chilocha Sudrors in G Love to Soul, Chilombi Drawers in G Love to Soul, Umtopa Sowers in G Love to Soul, Tupa Yishi Sucharwars in G Love to Soul. I pray for blessing me, my mind, and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing me, the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing me, the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing me, confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dang mu shin ke chokum da da mi ke nam dang roa tun ji da ke jit sam ho tam shi ke du da ke chit ten to in the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And then the bodhicitta, which pretty much corresponds to the first practice of a bodhisattva. And for those who have the sheet, you can chant along. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So what we're setting out to do and how we're going to do it. Always start that way. Anybody have anything before we do our meditation? If so, you can raise your hand or unmute yourself. or Deidre can just speak. She's not muted. All right, then we will do our meditation. The Two Wings of Awakening. And Susan, I need to catch you up on some of these documents. Unless, I don't know if Anne might have sent them to you, but anyway, there's a couple of pieces of paper that if you're going to be able to join us regularly, it would probably be good to have. But this meditation, those who have the sheet can look if they want to, but I'm doing it as a guided meditation, so the sheet is not necessary. It's called The Two Wings of Awakening, Cultivating Wisdom and Compassion. So first we just set ourselves up to meditate by checking in with our posture. Just making sure basically that our spine is straight but not rigid, and that our body is relaxed. So we're looking for a relaxed alertness both in our posture and in our mind. And to meditate, we simply resolve that we are going to not follow thoughts while we sit. Thoughts will come and go, but we're not going to get caught up in them, and inevitably we will. And that is not a failure of meditation. We will spend a fair amount of our meditating time generally caught up in thought. But where it becomes meditation is where we notice we're breaking patterns here. So we just, our resolution to, when we meditate, as far as not following thoughts goes, is to notice at some point when we're not following thought, when we are following thoughts, and then to disengage. So just take a moment to let our minds come to rest and to settle our awareness, our attention in our body, how it actually feels to be in this present moment, in this body, in this space, wherever we are, in this company. And then within this resting state, we contemplate the four reminders. First, just briefly, reminding ourselves about the precious human existence, that we now have all the conditions we need to attain awakening, to wake up to our full potential of wisdom and compassion, and we need to make use of it. And that is a feeling of gratitude and appreciation. And then we remember that it's a time-limited opportunity because of impermanence and death. It can end any time without warning, so we need to practice now. Just letting that settle into our stream of being. And then we remind ourselves of the law of karma taught by the Buddha, that what determines our future is our own actions in this lifetime. So we can act in ways that bring us suffering in the future, or happiness in the future, or liberation in the future. The choice is up to us in each of our actions. And then fourth, the suffering of samsara speaks for itself. Since there is no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence, we must use this life to free ourselves and others from it. From what we might call our homeland in the language of the 37 practices. And then, having reminded ourselves of why we're practicing the Dharma, we will bring our minds further into rest and focus by following our breath. You can count your breaths, or you can just follow your breath just for a few rounds. Counting on the out-breath, relaxing on the in-breath. Today we're going to use Pema Chodron's basic structure for doing taking and sending for both ultimate and relative bodhicitta. So her instruction for ultimate bodhicitta is simply to flash openness. That means to just let yourself rest, let your attention rest in open awareness, just directly. Vast, spacious, open, limitless awareness. And then within that open awareness, without losing touch with it, we can practice taking and sending alternately, practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. And we're going to use her approach to Tonglen today. So first we just begin noticing our breath again, following our breath, noticing each in-breath from beginning to end, each out-breath from beginning to end, within the context of open awareness. And then without bringing anything else to mind yet, we're going to bring texture to our breath, breathing in. When we breathe in, we think we're breathing in hot, heavy, dark, smoky light. Breathing it into our nostrils, and if we wish, through all the pores of our body, into our heart center, into our vast, spacious Buddha nature, which is no different from our open awareness, where it dissolves along with the in-breath. And breathing out white, refreshing moonlight. So we alternate these two textures. It can be on every set of breaths, or you can take breaks and just do it every few sets. Breathing in the dark, smoky texture. Letting it dissolve, breathing out white, refreshing, cool moonlight. And we should be very relaxed. If you have any tension in your body, in your eyes, in your mouth, just let go of it. Continue to breathe in the dark texture, breathe out the light texture. Starting this way just helps us synchronize a certain kind of awareness with our breath. Really just another way of doing calm abiding using the breath. Breathing in the dark, breathing out the light. Relaxed, full breaths. Still also resting in open awareness. And now we can think that when we breathe in this texture of dark, heavy, smoky light, it carries with it all the suffering of all sentient beings. And that we want to keep the framework of all sentient beings, but if specific people or animals or kinds of beings come to mind, that's fine too. Breathing in their suffering, whatever kind it is, and letting it dissolve into our vast Buddha nature. Breathing out to all sentient beings whatever will relieve their suffering. Breathing out freedom, peace, happiness, relaxation, fulfillment of their needs. And we can do this because it's in the context of the vastness, the limitlessness of our nature of open awareness. Not holding on to anything. Just breathing in, breathing out. Thinking that this is really happening, but within the context of knowing that everything is like a dream in some sense. We're really relieving sentient beings of their suffering, and they're really receiving freedom and happiness. And now we've let go of any visualization, any conceptuality, and go back to just following the breath very lightly within the context of open awareness. And now letting go, even of following the breath, just resting in open awareness, and then coming back to our regular state of mind, already in progress. And you can stretch or whatever you need to do to segue into study and contemplation mode. Okay. Anybody have any questions? Anybody, especially who may not have done this meditation before, if you have any questions about it, either unmute yourself or wave your hand. Deidre, did you have something?
No.
Okay. And you can hear okay still?
Yeah, I can. Thank you.
Okay, good. All right. Oh, Mark Hoyer. I love that come back to your regular state of mind already in progress. Well, we're not really losing touch with that, are we? But that's all right. You know, that's part of who we are and what our mind stream is. So we're just experimenting with different sort of ways of tuning into who and what we are at any given moment. All right. Okay, if there are no questions or comments other than Mark's, then we will move on to the silent pop quiz segment of our class. So let's see if we can bring to mind, just internally, without saying anything, what the first practice is. And I'm talking about just saying the name of it. So the first practice of a bodhisattva is to study, contemplate, and meditate. Second practice of a bodhisattva is to leave your homeland. Can you bring to mind the third practice of a bodhisattva? And those who have not, who are just joining us for the first time, don't worry about it. Third one is to rely on solitude. Fourth practice of a bodhisattva. Is to let go of attachment to this lifetime. And we are up to the fifth practice of a bodhisattva, to give up negative friends. Literally says bad friends in the Tibetan, to give up bad friends. I've softened that up and sort of, I think, tried to tune it more into our cultural process by saying not following friends who harm my practice. Like, that's very specific. Like, what kind of bad friends? Well, the ones who keep me from practicing in some way or impede my practice. And to give them up, like, what does that mean? That's something that, that's a question that gets asked a lot. Like, do I have to, like, repudiate all my friends who aren't Dharma practitioners? And the answer, I think, is not necessarily. I mean, there may be certain friends that you just have to cut ties with, but generally it just means not following them, not falling under their influence. So I translated it sort of in accordance with that, those thoughts. So I have another pop quiz for everybody. I know you'll really like this one today. So last week we had off. I hope everybody, it was a good break for everybody. Last time the verse was to let go of attachment to this lifetime. It was about the various manifestations of impermanence, that we're going to part ways with all of our friends and family, that we're going to lose all of our material possessions, at the very least when we die, if not before, and then even our consciousness is going to desert the guest house of the body. So our job as bodhisattvas is to let go of whatever attachments we have in this life, because they're all impermanent. So one thing that we talked about in that class was the signs of impermanence that Gampopa explains in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, or the Ornament of Precious Liberation. So he gave us three sort of hallmarks, like how we can tune into impermanence in our lives. He calls it subtle impermanence, but these particular three types of impermanence. Coarse or gross impermanence is like when worlds actually come to an end. And I may have said last time that looks like that one might be in sight. But so we might get to witness that, not for long, perhaps. But meanwhile, as long as the world system lasts, there's other kinds of impermanence, three specific kinds that we can tune into. So let's see if we remember those. Anybody wish to be unmuted and say what they are? Okay, so the first one is noticing day changing into night and night changing into day, that cycle of, you know, I can't think of the word for that. I'm sure there's a word for like what that, like the diurnal cycle or something. I'm sure there's a really good way to say that in one or two words, but just noticing the sunset and the sunrise, like another day is gone, another night is gone. Second one is noticing the seasons changing. And I'm noticing right now that the summer is now on the down, you know, downslide. We're getting into late summer manifestations. And then the third one is what's called moment-to-moment impermanence. We can just notice impermanence anytime we want to tune in to it. Like, these words are coming out of my mouth, and as each one comes out, it's gone. Any other thing, like we're aging moment by moment. We had lunch, and next we're going to have dinner. Like, lunch is gone. So many ways that impermanence manifests. And so it's really good to know those three sort of classic signs of impermanence that we can tune into anytime to help us keep it in mind. So next thing on the list then is, this is to chant the verses. So I'm going to share the screen and bring them up. I don't know if people, we need me to do that. If you have your sheet, then we don't need to bring it up on the screen. Anybody need it on the screen? Can say the thumbs up. Okay. Oh, yes, Susan definitely does. All right, I'm going to put it on the screen then. There it is. Okay, can you see that one? I'm going to have to scroll, as John pointed out to me in an email. I'm going to scroll for now. There's like an option to put two pages up, but I have to look that up. So can everybody see it okay? If not, you have to unmute yourself, because right now I can't see everybody. So we're going to chant these together. I'll scroll up as needed. Oh, wait a minute. I don't have to, if everybody can see it at this size, because all of the verses that we need today are on the screen. So we're going to chant them together. And we'll do the last one three times. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Okay, we'll do this one three times. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims, not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims, not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So for the third repetition, we're going to let the meaning sink in more. I'm just going to pause after each line, and we'll just almost do it as a contemplation combined with meditation. So that doesn't mean you have to let go of thoughts necessarily, but after each line, see what comes to mind and just sit with that for a moment. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade. Kindness and compassion are forgotten. And I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So let's let our minds come to rest for about a minute. So this is one way we could do our meditation session if we're doing our 5 minutes or more of meditation every day. If you need a focus, you know, if it's hard to meditate because you need something to do sort of to get into the meditation, you could chant the verse that we're working on. or all the verses, and then just rest with that. And, you know, you're not particularly following thoughts, but it somehow changes the, I don't know, the vibration or something of the meditation. So anybody have anything to say before we move on to the commentaries, which are all quite short this week?
I do, Lama.
Yes, Valerie and then Kathy.
That part about giving up bad friends, I keep thinking for me it's the television.
Oh, Pema Chodron says the same thing. That was like the punchline of the whole class. That's great. Yeah, she says it doesn't have to be a person. It could be, for her, it's her iPhone, obviously, or her phone. I don't know if it's an iPhone, but her phone. So we were going to read a little bit from her commentary at the end. She says it can also be substances, like, you know, whatever gets us into trouble and takes us away from the Dharma. That's a great observation, Valerie. You and Pema Chodron are on the same wavelength here.
As they say, from your lips to God's ears.
Yeah. Kathy, I'm going to unmute you.
Thank you.
Okay, you're good.
It's interesting because I've been dealing with difficult people for a little while in extremely difficult circumstances. One of my stepson died last week, and my friend, who's been like my sister, is probably starting to actively die now. And so, but it's really interesting because what I'm finding is it is the bad behavior that I, you know, many years ago, I would have been really right in the middle of. I'm so conscious of not doing that, and so conscious of trying to maintain kindness and compassion and not smacking them. but it's, you know, it's interesting because I've been very aware of this verse during this time. So that's it.
Okay, thank you for sharing. I just want to say hi to Clementine, Dan's daughter, Clementine, joining us. But thank you. That was very touching, actually. it's actually, I've noticed, like, this is only peripherally related, but in particularly stressful times, stress can be another thing that can really derail our practice. We can lose kindness and compassion when we're under stress. You know, even like the most dharmic people sometimes.
Yeah.
It's not exactly the same, but you're talking about actual people, like dealing with people not at their best.
Yeah.
So that's another influence we don't want to fall under. Obviously, when people are stressed, when they're dying, when they're going through horrible life experiences, they're not at their best. And we could fall under that influence. That could totally influence us to respond in kind or to see them in a certain way that would not be compassionate.
Yeah.
So this actually, you know, this topic has a big scope.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have something to say? Uh-oh, yeah, okay, Susan. Okay, you're on, Susan.
Well, I wanted to and I'm not sure here if this is your translation, Linda, but that not following the friends who harm my practice. Because if I think about, having gratitude for annoying people in my life, right? Because those are my teachers, all right? Mm-hmm. So that, I don't want to, number five, I don't want it to conflict with that, okay?
Yeah.
But to me, the clarifier is not following them. In other words, yeah, those annoying people, they're always going to show up. Pema calls them Juan and Juanita, but I mean, and they do. But to remember to use them as teachers, and not following the friends who harm my practice. So I'm not sure if that was your line, Linda. Is that your line? That
it is. This is my translation, and that's exactly why I translated it that way. It's like it's easy to say to give up friends, you know, or to give up negative friends, but then the question arises: what does that mean? And again, like Valerie, who brought up something that is gonna, we're gonna see in the commentaries, like, what does it mean to, you know, to not follow a friend, to give up a friend, to reject a friend's influences? Like, how can we do that in a compassionate way? Because we definitely don't want to lose sight of the compassion aspect. Thank you, Susan. Namdak, did you have something to say?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Okay. Anybody else? Marilyn, you are unmuted.
I don't know whether to get to this now or to wait till we get to the point in Dingo Kensi's commentary. Nor do I know whether you just want to skip this altogether.
I wanted to do it next week. But go ahead and say what it is.
If the teacher in whom you place your confidence is someone whose views and conduct are erroneous.
Yeah, I knew that was going to come up. I thought it would be Patrick who would bring that up. But we can talk about that today because it is in the commentary. But what I'd rather do is put it off until next week when we're talking about the spiritual friend, because I think it fits in.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting and perhaps illuminating discussion.
Okay. That's fine with me. Yeah,
because this is something we're dealing with this viscerally right now. What is the authentic spiritual friend that you should cherish more than your own life? I don't know if everybody's read the Dingo Chensei commentary yet, but he includes under the category of bad friends or bad company, spiritual teachers who let us down, you know, in their conduct or whatever. So anyway, I think it's just like that would be a whole, especially for us as students of KTC, I think right now it's just such a big discussion that I think next week is the spiritual friends discussion, and we'll do it more then. If anybody has anything they want to say about it now, though, totally fair game. I'm not going to read that part of the commentary today. I'm actually just picking and choosing in the commentary. I'm not reading the whole thing. Yes, Patrick.
It occurs to me that it might be less loaded for us to talk about maybe the example of Sojo Rinpoche right now, who's in total collapse.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be quite as personal for us, but it still would be real.
Yeah, I think we're almost lucky in that sense that happened right now because it's taken a lot of the attention. I think, so next week, I think everybody here knows about the situation at KTC. Susan, I don't know if you do. Okay, well, Anne, are you able to fill her in? Or Susan, I can talk to you. Yeah, if Anne can fill you in on that, that would be great. There's just been some questions about some conduct by our teacher, Lamanor Rinpoche. So it's a very live topic right now, the spirit, the authentic spiritual friend. And I have certainly some things to share, some thoughts to share on that. And I'm sure that everybody else does too, or other people do too.
I can send you something. I mean, when I'm up here at Commonweal, I can mail things out. I can when I'm downtown, but I can send you a sweet something that somebody forwarded to us that was in the subject of Sojo Rinpoche, but it was a very sweet four-liner. So I'll email that to you today.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So that'll be our discussion next week, and we can definitely bring it into our present concerns. You know, I think it's tailor-made for us to talk about that topic. So anybody have anything else before we look at Dingo Chensi's commentary? Yes, John, I'm unmuting you now. Whoops. Okay.
I just wanted to see if I can clarify spiritual friend, the definition there. Are we talking about ordinary people, or are we talking about teachers? Are they two separate, the same? Because in the Dzogchen tradition, spiritual friend refers to the teacher,
yeah,
not like senior students or Dharma friends.
Yes.
So I was curious.
Well, I looked at all the commentaries, not only these, but there's a couple other commentaries I have that we're not particularly using for the class, and every one of them addresses only the teacher aspect. of it. So, and I think that that's like spiritual friend in the Mahayana tradition. That, which, you know, that's the Ornament of Precious Liberation. That's the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. It's a name for the teacher. You know, when Gampopa says that we need an authentic teacher as one of the prerequisites for following the path, the word he uses is spiritual friend, Gewe Shenyen in Tibetan. I personally, off the record, I guess, think that our fellow practitioners are part of the mix. Those are the kind of, I mean, those are also friends who help our Dharma practice. What would we do without each other? Just the teacher and us. Like, you also need the support of other practitioners, especially now, like with what we're going through at KTC. You know, we have a community. We're not on our own with everything. So I personally think that it includes both. But I think the intention of the text itself is really about the teacher, because you know what? They didn't have community in the same sense that we do. You know, they had the monastery, but the teacher was at the monastery. This was, you know, a lot of this is for monastics. That was the audience. Well, they were all relying on the spiritual friend and maybe not so much on each other, because the teacher was always directly there. But for us, community is really an important support. That's something that, you know, that we can talk about too. Again, that's like next week's topic. But I think that's another thing that we can talk about and share our thoughts on that.
Okay.
Thank you, John. Anybody else have anything? Oh, all right. I think I have everybody muted. Oh, Fanny, let's see if we can hear you. Oh, Deidre, did you have something?
No, I thought you were trying to see if I was still here.
Oh, no, I was, I'm sorry. You might not be able to hear everybody really well, but yeah, Fanny had something to share.
Oh, okay.
I don't think we can hear you, Fanny. So can you type it? Is it typable? We don't mind waiting while you type it. I think we need to also have Fanny on speakerphone. I could add you to my call, Fanny. I'm making myself a note to next week put Fanny on speakerphone. And we can all use this as a moment to just let our minds come to rest or do some taking and sending. Okay, Fanny says, I don't know if everybody can see it. I know David can probably see it too. Verse 5 talks about friends that are reinforcing negative habits in myself. The way that I'm reading your question, Fanny, I'm not 100% sure I got it all, but it's the same question that maybe Susan was asking, that like... There is the question, this was the contemplation for this week, was can we maintain our friendship with them in some compassionate way? Isn't the barrier not theirs but mine? Well, yeah, I think that is the question. I think that's a really important question, a really central question. I think our barriers vary in strength, and especially in some relationships. It can be very, very hard to break a pattern within the relationship. So I think that's a question we have to answer for ourselves and if for each relationship that's troubling us. Whether, I mean, ideally, sure, we can keep the friendship intact and not just not be influenced. We can make our barrier, our boundary stronger. But I think there could be some friends, and even I've even had this advice from Lama Norla in the past. Some friends, we can't break out of the pattern, and we always fall. You know, it's just we're not strong enough yet in our Dharma practice. And so you just have to make that decision. But if you have to actually, like, really let go of a friendship or take a break from a friendship, we can do that compassionately. And again, we're going to get to that in the commentaries. Does that help to answer the question? As bodhisattvas, we don't shut anybody out, you know, but as aspiring bodhisattvas, like people who are still working within our limitations, sometimes I think we might have to make a separation, at least temporarily. But that's for each of us to answer. Thank you for that question. Okay, anybody else have anything to share? Then we will turn to Dingo Chensi's commentary. And it's very short, just a couple of pages, and we're just going to read a little bit of it just to hit the high points. So he begins by saying, and I think this is just a lovely metaphor, this is exactly it. A crystal, when placed on a piece of cloth, takes on the color of that cloth, whether white, yellow, red, or black. In the same way, the friends with whom you keep company the most often, whether suitable or unsuitable, will greatly influence the direction your life and practice take. And I think, again, that answers Fanny's question, that as long as we're like the crystal and we take on the coloration, you know, of whatever company we're keeping, then we have to be careful not to keep company that's going to derail our practice and our Dharma attitude. But, I mean, somebody like Kalu Rinpoche maybe wasn't a crystal, like Dingo Chense Rinpoche. They're not like that. Like, they don't take on the coloration. They're like, their realization is at a point, I believe. Situ Rinpoche, the Dalai Lama, like, they're not affected by somebody encouraging them to do something negative. They're very solid in their practice and their bodhisattvaness. And when we're there, and we may be there with some friends, you know, that I'm not having what you're having, but I love you and you can hang out with me anyway, then that's fine. But with some friends, we may not be there. I know I certainly have some friends that I can't, it's just too hard to break the pattern when I'm with them. So we can remember the crystal that takes on the color of its cloth. So then I'm skipping the part where he talks about the negative friend or the negative company, also referring to the teacher, because we're going to talk about that next week. So he says, as for unsuitable friends, and that's the translation used here by the Padmakara translation committee. The Tibetan literally says bad friends, Drokpa Nyampo, Drokpo Nyampo, or Drokmen. So it's translated different ways by different people, and here it's unsuitable friends. So what is meant here is those who have the effect on you of increasing your three negative emotions, hatred or anger, attachment or desire, and stupidity or ignorance, and who encourage you to commit negative actions. And skipping ahead a bit, an unsuitable friend is one who is fond of distractions, and so many kinds of distractions, right? Let's spend the evening watching, you know, binge watching something on TV. You know, that might be fine sometimes, but to the point where it impedes your Dharma practice, it's probably not a good idea. So someone who's fond of distractions, totally immersed in ordinary worldly activities, and who does not care in the least about achieving liberation. That's his definition, Dingo Chensi's definition of the kind of friend that we want to not follow. Such people will prevent you from spending any time studying, reflecting, and meditating, which are the roots of liberation. So that's the problem. You know, it's really like we all engage in some level of distractions. But as long as we have time to consistently engage in our Dharma practice, I don't think we have to give everything up. But when it becomes this kind of a problem where we're prevented from spending any time, like we could just never get to our practice or lose our motivation to get to our practice, that it really is a problem, because we will not become liberated in that case. And here we go with the metaphor that we have in verse one, this precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free. An unsuitable friend is like a bad captain who steers his ship onto the rocks. We don't want our ship to end up on the rocks. So Dingo Chensei says, such people are your worst enemy. You owe it to yourself to stay away from them. So that's Dingo Chensei's advice and exhortation. These people can really harm our chances of attaining freedom of mind, possibly of getting a precious human existence again, if we really squander it in this lifetime or use it in, you know, in destructive ways. So we really have to take care of that problem. This is an important thing to keep in mind. I'm going to go on to Ken's. I'm keeping an eye out to see if anybody wanted to say anything, and I'm opening up Ken's on my Kindle, Ken's commentary. Yes. Who's this? Is this Deidre?
Yeah, I was just looking at the bottom of that next paragraph, and he describes an authentic spiritual friend.
Wait, Deidre, stop for a second. I think that we can hear you through the computer. Oh, we can hear you, right. So, so Deidre, go ahead. I'm just getting feedback from hearing you. I'm moving the phone away. Okay, that's it. Okay, now Deidre, please go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. So, anyway, he says, authentic spiritual friends are those who have received teachings from the same teacher as yourself.
Okay.
And detached from worldly concerns. And are devoting themselves to practice in secluded places.
Okay, are you on page 75 here?
Yeah, at the bottom of the page. Right.
Okay, so that answers, was that John's question? That answers John's question.
Right.
Even though in the chapter on spiritual friends, they only talk about the teacher, here he very, very clearly states that it's our Dharma brothers and sisters as well. Thanks for pointing that out. That's in the last paragraph on page 75. Everybody hear Deidre? Okay, great. Thank you. Anything else, Deidre?
No.
Okay. Great. I know what I need to do. Well, never mind. Okay. So I'm on Ken's commentary now. Oh, anybody else had anything? Okay. I'm on Ken's commentary in Reflections on Silver River, and he has some interesting advice here. Oops, I'm on verse 6. All right. My Kindle is a little slow sometimes. Okay, so the highlights of Ken's commentary. How many people have Reflections on Silver River? Okay. And so a few of us don't have it. I'm just going to read through his commentary because it's not very long. He says, like attracts like, anger reinforces anger, greed begets greed, indifference breeds indifference. Your circle of friends and associates reflects your values, your behaviors, and how you experience life. So who we hang out with is who we are. And I found this next paragraph, particularly resonant. He said, you also know the power of peer pressure. So that's what this is talking about, is peer pressure, one of the things it's talking about. The power of domination and the power of inclusion and exclusion. You experienced it in school, you experience it at work, and you encounter it in every social context, including sometimes in the Dharma Center. In my experience, you know, whenever we're around people, these same patterns can come into play, and we can find ourselves falling into the same pattern of response. I particularly think when I read this of, like, I don't really get together anymore with people I went to high school with or college with, but I've seen in myself and others how easy, like, when you get together with somebody like you went to high school with, you just immediately like just snap right into that same pattern of how you related to them and how they influenced how you saw the world. Like, just right away. It's just like, I don't know what it's just like, but it's like something. again, I yes, Marilyn, thank you for saving me from, maybe you have something good to say.
Well, it's sort of the same sort of thing, the complaints about you've been away from home for ages and you go home to your, you know, you and your mother, my mother treats me just like, you know, I was 10 years old and you know, and the same sort of deal. I mean, those of us
react in the same way as when you were 10 years old, right? Or you can. Yes, thanks. Anything else, Marilyn?
Nope.
Yeah, yeah. Well, family dinners like Thanksgiving, Christmas, all of those, you know, kind of get-togethers where you don't see people for a long time, and maybe you knew them from your childhood. And darn, it just happens. No matter how much you resolve, you're going to go in as an adult, and you're going to, like, not fall into that again. It still happens. So this is why we need boundaries, or why sometimes we need to just stay out of it. So Ken goes on to say, it is the same internally too. Like, we can be our own worst friend, right? Which stories about you or your life do you repeat to yourself over and over again? Which behaviors do you nourish in yourself, indulge in yourself, or ignore in yourself? Fanny says that she's experiencing that now, being in the fabric of family since childhood, right, what we were talking about before, because Fanny's moved from Maryland to Kansas City to be with her mother, and you have other family there as well? Yeah. So you're experiencing this now, falling back into the same patterns. 12 years, yeah. That's a lot. Well, that would be a very powerful influence, but I hope you're able to maintain your autonomy, I guess, your autonomy and your Dharma practice and your, you know, your Dharmic view of things in the midst of all that, because it can be really hard.
I unmuted myself to say that this little paragraph about the internal situation reminds me so much of To Give Up All My Habits and Reactions, This Homeland Where I've Dwelt for All My Life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds the same.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It takes us right back into our homeland. I mean, that is the homeland that in practice too, like, we're actually encouraged to pack up and move. Like, just move out of it. Because that's how, like, traditional Tibetans saw it. Because you were stuck in one place. Like, they didn't travel around like we do or move every 2 years. It's like, to get away from all of those influences and patterns and reactions, sometimes you have to just pack up and get out of there. So yeah, it's harking back to verse 2. So also sort of harking back to verse 2, Ken goes on to say, you want to change how you experience life, but you may not want anything else to change. Is that possible? Sooner or later, you have to face this squarely. So I find that not entirely clear, but I think what he's saying here is that you want to be a bodhisattva. You want to be a Dharma practitioner. You want to change your experience of life and your reactivity, but you don't want to change anything else. And sometimes you have to change something else. You have to, like, confront, like, what is it? What are the people? What are the patterns? What are the situations that is bringing this out in me? And do I need to step away from that, you know, at least temporarily, to allow myself the space to actually, you know, affect this change? He says, take a look around you. Look at your friends and associates. Ask yourself, is this how I want to behave? Is this how I want to live? Is this how I want to be? Look inside too and ask, is this how I want to be thinking and feeling? So we're really, I'm glad you brought that up, Marilyn, because we're really looking at the homeland right now. Like, we're really putting the homeland under a microscope. If the answer is no, then you begin. And so he tells us, so what is it that you do then? He gives us some advice. He says, start with what is inside you, those internal voices, those internal patterns. When you find yourself repeating the same behavior over and over again, give it a name. Oh, I am succumbing to, you know, my ice cream addiction again. Oh, I am, you know, I'm sitting in front of the TV as soon as I get home from work again. And, you know, 3 hours later, I'm still going to be sitting here. So give it a name. Learn to recognize that behavior and call it by its name. And I find that helpful too. Like, just say what it is. Like, just say in your own mind what it is you're doing. And that allows you sometimes to see it more clearly. He says, when you name something, it loses power. Just ask Rumpelstiltskin. I think we're all old enough, except Clementine, to know what that means. I don't know, Dan, you know Rumpelstiltskin? No, Dan doesn't know Rumpelstiltskin either. It's an old fairy tale. What? Oh, wait a minute. Let me unmute you, Dan.
Oh, no, I know Rumpelstiltskin, but Clem doesn't yet.
No, Clem, do we even tell those stories anymore to children?
Yeah, those fairy tales are great.
Oh, good. Yeah. I did with my daughter.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'm muting you again. And so that's one thing we can do is just name things. It's very similar, actually, to how Pema Chodron used to teach meditation, like to beginning meditators. Maybe she still does, but and I think she probably got this from Trungpa, that when you're meditating, you know, the object of meditation is not to fall into thinking, like actually creating trains of thought, which we call thinking. And so her advice was that whenever you find yourself, you catch yourself caught in a train of thought, you just label it thinking. That kind of neutralizes it. Like, it. Okay, I got you. It's like, okay, I got you. You're thinking. Instead of, you know, it becomes not this amorphous thing, but it's very defined. Like, either I'm thinking or I'm not engaged in thinking. So you label it when you catch it. I do that with ego clinging sometimes. Like, aha, ego clinging, I got you. I just saw that. It really does take some of the power out of it. It gives us a foothold. So he says, and the result of this, the result of just catching ourselves like this, labeling things, noticing our behavior patterns, is that little by little, you change. You do not enjoy bantering the way you used to. You find it jarring, unkind, and mindless. Gossiping, say, he might get to that, but bantering or gossiping, maybe gossip just isn't, like, you used to really get into it with this friend, and now it's like, ew, you know, I really, could we talk about something else? The old haunts, the old interests, the usual topics of conversation engage you less and less. Maybe TV becomes a little less interesting. I don't know. You feel you are a performer putting on a bit of an act to be one of the gang. It doesn't fit you anymore. You are not sure how much longer you can keep it up. At some point, you stop trying and you let it all drop. So what he's describing here is not like a blunt instrument approach. It's like we simply make this one small change of bringing something to our attention again and again. Bringing it to our attention is not trying to change it or cut it off. It's just noticing it and labeling it. And then it's an organic process from there. You know, all you really have, it's like with meditation, you don't have to make yourself meditate. That's called contrivance. And that's not really effective meditation. When you try to make your mind peaceful. Like, it doesn't work, and then you get all frustrated. But if you just sit and say, I'm going to not follow thoughts as much as I can, and when I catch myself thinking, I'm going to say thinking, and I'm going to come back to my breath or whatever, and then organically, without you having to exert an effort beyond deciding where your attention is going to be, it happens, and you get caught in fewer chains of thought, and you find your mind is more peaceful. Anyway, so he's describing,
I think about it as putting my mind on vacation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lama Norla used to call it that too. He said, the only way to take a vacation is to meditate. Mm-hmm. That's the only vacation. Okay, anything else, Valerie? I see you've muted, so, but yeah, anybody, please, if I'm not noticing you have something to say, please unmute yourself. So, very organic process. And I wanted to say, I saw a quote from Trump Rinpoche somewhere recently. The same old thing, like, he talked a lot about making friends with yourself and Pema Chodron. Actually, what I ran across was with a quote from Pema Chodron, too, about we're not trying to change ourselves. We're not trying to make ourselves be something different or some better person. We're just following the instructions of the practice, and everything else takes care of itself. I mean, we're not trying to make ourselves a nice person. By all accounts, Marpa was not a nice person. He was a very angry person who yelled at people a lot. Or as Mark says, or you become aware of the naturally peaceful nature of your mind. That's exactly the process, is that it's already there. Thank you, Mark. It's already there. We're just uncovering it. But it's not, again, a blunt instrument approach. We're just given an instruction. We follow it in a very relaxed way, an alert but relaxed way, just like with meditation. And it happens. It just happens on its own. The path unfolds. So Ken goes on to say, there is loss, definitely. And with loss, there is grief, the pain of separating from patterns and people. Yet you feel lighter and clearer, as if you had set down a coat or a mask that you had been wearing for no apparent reason. So we have to respect this. If there is a sense of loss, we cherish this friend, but every time we're with her, we waste like our entire day. So stepping back into either like not seeing the friend or having a different relationship with the friend can definitely feel like a loss, and we have to be honest about that too. We have to respect our own processes, you know, in a compassionate and kind but honest way. But we still got to keep our eye on the ball too. Like, you have to decide, back to the third verse, you know, about removing yourself, relying on solitude, removing yourself from distractions, removing yourself from conditions that are disturbing. I forgot what I was going to say. But anyway, back to verse 3. Oh, well. All right, but he goes on to say a caution, and this is really important, a caution. As these changes unfold, you may see your new direction as better, as superior to your old ways. That is only natural, but it is easy to fall into another old habit, criticizing and disparaging the friends and the ways of life you are leaving behind. So that was brought up by, I forget by whom. We want to be compassionate in this. Maybe that was Susan. We want to be compassionate in this. We're not rejecting people. We're simply like making our own boundary less permeable. You know, we're making ourselves less susceptible, but we're not rejecting them, and we're not disparaging them, even in our own mind. Because that is the homeland again. We're like back to the homeland. If we find ourselves being judgmental and arrogant and I'm better than you now, I have to get rid of you because, you know, I'm on to better things now. And you're just a wreck. You're wasting your life. It's not helpful to think like that. We just look at what we need to do. Always, again, wisdom. This is wisdom, is seeing. The wisdom component is seeing things the way that they are. Ultimate bodhicitta, the nature of mind, the way things actually exist, like a dream, whatever. But we always, the other wing is compassion, and we can't lose sight of that. All wisdom has to take place within a setting of compassion. And the other way around too, all compassion has to take place within a setting of wisdom. As Sita Rinpoche, when Sita Rinpoche taught at KTC last year, and I hope I won't lose the thread on this, we gave him the topic, the relationship between compassion and wisdom. So he talked a lot about compassion without wisdom. You can definitely have compassion without wisdom. It's called idiot compassion, and it means that you're helping people in ways that are not helpful. Either they don't want the help and it's causing them frustration, or by helping them, you're actually hindering them in a spiritual way, you know, or a way of like standing on their own feet or whatever. Anybody who's a parent or has ever taken care of anybody knows what that is. But then he got to wisdom without compassion, and he said it doesn't exist. Like, there, you can have compassion without wisdom, but you can't have wisdom without compassion. We cannot fully see the way things are if we're not also focused on compassion, if we're not also in a context of compassion. So that's the caution. That's the disclaimer. You know, we're rejecting the behaviors, but we're not rejecting the people. He says, if you find yourself becoming critical and judgmental, let it go. So again, it's just recognizing, you could label that. Judgment, ego clinging, thinking, judging, being arrogant. We can label all of those things. He says, you are falling back into old patterns, exactly what you wanted to leave behind. So we've come full circle again to the second verse, leaving your homeland. And we have 15 minutes left. I'm going to read you a little bit of Pema Chodron's commentary. And then we can have some discussion, and we can, if we have time, we'll do a little meditation. So Pema Chodron says, the main theme of this verse is how the company you keep either hinders the process of awakening or fosters it. What's more important, the inner or the outer dynamic? Because we're told to look inward, right, and not be affected by what's happening outside. She says, how we relate to what's more important, inner or outer, how we relate to what's happening or what's happening. In Buddhist teachings, and I think this is, again, an important point, in Buddhist teachings, usually the inner dynamic is considered more important, to hold it in awareness, to be open rather than to contract, you know, rather than to cut things off, go inward, work with your own mind. But you can't, she says, you can't underestimate what's happening on the outside. And she brings us back to that third verse, the third practice of a bodhisattva, to rely on solitude, which Ken translates as to rely on silence. She says, back to silence. We need to be able to self-reflect and go deeper so we can take advantage of situations to use them as the path of awakening. And that is the answer to the question of whether this is just an internal thing, like, isn't this just about setting our own boundaries? Sometimes the external thing is too strong for our boundaries. I'll get to you in a sec, Fanny. So while it's true that Dharma is all about working with our own mind and not being at the mercy of outer things happening, we're not there yet. You know, we're just on the path. So sometimes we have to work with outer circumstances as well. Fanny, let's see what you had to say. What are the best ways to handle being excluded by others and not feel rejected? Go where the inclusion is. I find this a difficult habit. I don't know that I have any advice there. I think it's very situation dependent. What I would work with if I were feeling rejected is my feeling of rejection. I would go straight to meditation with that. In terms of working with the outer situation, I think that's up to you. Again, it's probably very situational. There may be times when you need to reach out to people and go where the people are, but if they're leading you away from the Dharma, then that's the point of this verse, that would not be helpful. But being excluded by others isn't necessarily a problem unless it makes us feel rejected. And then I think we have to ask, like, what is this feeling of rejection? Like, what does rejection feel like? Why getting our center back through meditation, through sort of analyzing what's happening to us internally through contemplation and meditating on it. It is difficult. Interpersonal dynamics are a very difficult thing. And that is the whole basis of mind training, is that we always bring it back to mind training. You could do taking and sending. You have to decide how you're going to work with the outer situation and if there's something you need to change up there. But it's always fuel for working with our own mind, whatever's happening to us, especially whatever kind of adversity. Mind training is all about bringing it onto the path immediately. So back to Pema Chodron. Right. So that's kind of what she says, back to silence. Okay, I think Pema Chodron's answering your question. You can't underestimate what's happening on the outside, but we need to go inward and find that solitude, that silence, to be able to reflect and go deeper so that we can then use these situations on the path. It's like that internal compass is going to tell you how to use that external situation. So we want to always keep in close touch with that as much as we can. She says, I don't like the term bad friends. Again, that is the literal Tibetan. It's relative, so no one is intrinsically a bad friend. But for you, it might be clear that when you're together with a certain person, the tendency to gossip gets stronger, the tendency to distract and entertain and avoid what you are feeling gets stronger. And here's the crux of, you know, the thing I find most interesting in what she brings to this discussion. These particular friends can be substances that increase your confusion and entangle you more. It's the ice cream, you know. It could be the ice cream that's your bad friend that you have to think about if you have to completely cut off the relationship or if you can, you know, keep it but not fall under that influence of the homeland of habitual reactions. She used Ken MacLeod's book as the main text when she was teaching this seminar. She says, Ken MacLeod makes a wonderful point here. Sometimes you have to distance yourself in order to self-reflect and follow your deepest feeling of what is forward, healthy, open, and compassionate. But you might replace that with disdain or putting down those other people. That's just replacing one fixed polarizing habit with another. No need to make them bad. And she says here, I had to put that iPhone in a box and wrap it up and hide it. It's not always people. Her bad friend was her iPhone. And she said that in another verse, that when she went in, she was doing her retreat. I guess she kept her phone at first, but then she had to have somebody wrap it up and take it away. She says, at my age, and she's like 80, she just turned 81, at my age, when I spend 3 hours on an electronic device, I feel a little sick to my stomach for the wasted time. Not, wow, was that ever interesting, but wow, I don't have much time left, and I just wasted 3 hours. All right, that's the commentaries. We have 10 minutes left, 9, maybe 8. I think my clock might be 1 minute ahead. Anybody got anything they would like to say? So I have, Marilyn.
I have a question on that. When I explain to meditation to people, I use that thinking. Am I correct in saying that that is mind looking at mind? You are in the greater awareness. So that, and I mean, I've always told people that's it.
That's the beginning of it. I would say that's the beginning of it. It certainly has deeper levels and deeper meanings too. And I don't know how Situ Rinpoche would answer this question, but to me, that is mind looking at mind. You're catching your mind. You're seeing your mind's behavior. When you can say, I'm thinking, you've already taken yourself out of it.
Yeah.
Lama.
Hold on just a sec. Anything else, Marilyn?
Nope, that's it.
Yeah, that was a good observation. Yes, I think that is mind looking at mind. Valerie, was that you?
I'm just having a comment here because I've just been reading about this, and this book would say it's awareness looking at mind.
Right. Same thing, though. I think that the word mind, you know, I don't know the Tibetan. I think they still say mind looking at mind in Tibetan. It's one aspect of mind looking at another aspect of mind, you could say, because there's a shade of difference between catching the mind, you know, the thinking thing and what's looking at the thinking thing.
But they have to be different. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they couldn't distinguish, right?
Right. But on the other hand, one is a manifestation of the other, right? Because if everything takes place within mind, then that's a particular thing. This is why it's very hard to talk about the nature of mind. But if mind encompasses everything, like what is that mind? And it's like, you know, the ocean and the waves analogy. So the waves, they are like, you could say the wave is different from the ocean because it's exactly the same. You could say the wave is different from the ocean, but really the wave is an aspect of the ocean. It's not really different. It just looks different. Is that making sense?
Well, what I was reading made, you know, I'm not explaining it as well. Yeah. It made a lot of sense to me, and they make a difference with it.
Yeah.
It's like the ground of your being is awareness, where mind is a function of your ego, no?
Say that again.
The ground of your being is awareness, but your mind has more to do with your ego and your body.
Well, what then? What does the ocean and wave analogy mean to you? If mind is like an ocean and thoughts are like waves, aren't they all the same thing?
No, I can understand what you're saying, but like when you try to understand, or when I try to understand enlightenment, it's a kind of an awareness that is beyond mind.
Yeah. Right, it's beyond the limited mind that is the mind of a sentient being. You know, when we're looking at the nature of mind, we're definitely looking at something that's bigger, and yet you can't say that it's a different thing. It's like not two things.
Yeah, but when we're in our what we're here now with, our being in our body and our identity, we've separated the two things.
Yeah, that's relative reality. That's what's called relative reality. In ultimate reality, they're not different.
I know, but I don't see ultimate reality. I mean, I would like to, and I'm trying to.
Right. So what's the distinction you're making then, between, like, the thing that's...
Well, I'm trying to understand it to get there. You know?
I think we're almost out of time, so we probably can't continue this discussion now. I can stay on for a few minutes, as I have in the last...
That's all right. I think we would just go round and around with it.
Well, we might get somewhere, but it would take time. And I think it's one of those imponderables, you know, it's like you just have to see it.
Yes.
Essentially, we'll see it very clearly, I think. Mark says, how about becoming one's own spiritual friend, making your own mind your spiritual friend? Spiritual friend mind says, pay attention to the ocean, not the waves. Okay. Yeah, I think we're all, like, it's all, we're all getting there. It's all in the same direction, but it's something that we have to, before we can really get it, we have to experience it. So it's something we can keep talking about, only just not right now because we're out of time. So thank you, Valerie, for bringing that up. All right, so I have the class notes for today, which I will put up this afternoon, which covers the same ground pretty much that we covered today. I may add one or two things from the discussion. And it has a contemplation. So next week we will be looking at verse 6, which you already have, which is about the spiritual friend. And we can all give that some thought this week and next week meet and see what we all have to contribute to that discussion of what is an authentic spiritual friend. Namdak, did you have something to say? Yeah. Oh, no. Okay. I seem to want you to speak, Namdak. I'm missing your voice. All right. So that's the contemplation for next week is just that. I've written it in the class notes, so you can check it there. But it's basically, so keep reviewing. My suggestion is keep reviewing all of the verses up to now and their commentaries as you have time. It's not a hugely time-consuming thing to reread the commentary for any given verse, and it will help keep it fresh. So we're not like moving on to the next verse and like forgetting everything that came before. We want to keep it all alive as much as we can, because these are all things that we're going to be working on for a long time, probably many lifetimes from here. It's not like, okay, I got leaving my homeland, and I got, now I've got impermanence. We didn't get them. We're still mostly living, you know, as if we didn't get them. So we need to keep reviewing those. But in the meantime, we're moving on to verse 6. And so for next week, also read, you know, practice with verse 6 and read the commentary on verse 6. And we will have a good discussion of that next week. Anybody got anything else to say before we do our dedication? I'm finding the right folder with the prayers. Okay. All right. Well, I think it's been a good topic of study. I appreciate everybody's contributions to it. Mark Hoyer, you agree with what? A good topic of discussion, yes. Yeah. I think it's a tough one. This is a tough practice and what it requires. And we need to keep contemplating that one too. And that contemplation is included in the class notes for this week. Contemplating, like, in our, this is not an abstract thing. Like, we're really meant to look at our friendships, our friendships with people, our friendships with substances, our friendships with food, our friendships with our iPhone, our iPad, our computer, our TV, and see what is impeding our practice. You know, again, and that brings us back to verse 3, like we have to really decide what our priorities are. So if our priorities are defined, then how do we bring them, you know, how do we bring them to reality? I see you're smiling, Marilyn. We'll do our prayers, and then I can stay on for a few minutes if anybody wants to chat. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, kuntuzam poen manjushri, to train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And we will just bring our minds to rest for a few seconds. Back again into the feeling of our body in this present moment. And we are only a minute late by my clock. So anybody who needs to leave, please, you'll find your end meeting button, I think at the bottom of the screen. And I'm gonna unmute everybody. If I can find the icons, I've lost the icons. There they are. Here we go.
Bye.
Hi, Deidre. Glad you can join us, Deidre.
Thank you. Me too. Hope I get the audio next time.
Yeah, well, I think John's going to try to help you troubleshoot that.
All right. Thanks, John.
Deidre, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Deidre.
Happy birthday.
August 3rd.
Shoot.
What?
I'm trying to get over to suicide. Happy birthday, Deirdre.
Okay.
Linda. Thank you, Ian, for connecting.
Great to see you.